Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism. Welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. We're going to talk today about the effort to end the longest-running civil war in the Americas, one that's killed 220,000 people. Now, just over a month ago, people in Colombia went to the polls to vote on a proposed peace deal that would end 52 years of fighting with the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC. This deal had a lot of support. Both the leadership of the FARC and the Colombian government supported it. So did the Obama administration, the UN, the European Union, Pope Francis, and even the Cuban government. Polls showed that 60% of Colombians supported it as well. But in a shock vote on October 2nd, Colombians rejected the peace deal by a razor-thin margin. Now, that was a big embarrassment for Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos, who had made the deal the centerpiece of his administration. So the question is, what happens next in Colombia? The FARC has agreed to continue a ceasefire until the end of the year, but it's also warned that the country could soon become, quote, hell without a new peace deal. In a few minutes, we'll bring in a great panel of experts who are going to hash some of this out for us. But joining us first to give us a bit of background is Vicente Benitez in New York. He's written a number of articles on the conflict and is professor of constitutional law at Colombia's Universidad de La Sabana. Vicente, welcome to Global Journalist.
Good morning, and thank you for the invitation.
Well, Colombia was bitterly divided about this peace deal, and I understand that even within your own family, you voted for this deal, your wife voted against us. Tell us why the two of you divided on this issue.
The peace deal, unfortunately or fortunately, I don't know, has created this kind of polarization back in Colombia, because there are some issues in which the people actually strongly support some of the ideas regarding the demobilization of the guerrillas. But unfortunately, other sectors of the population back in Colombia, they strongly disagree with the idea of more lenient punishments against the former guerrilla members. So in my opinion, that's one of the most controversial topics. And in my personal case, my wife disagreed with the idea of not having harsh penalties when it comes to the criminal punishments.
So this was sort of the key factor for a lot of people in voting against the peace deal, was this idea that people who had been FARC guerrillas, who may have been involved in extortion, kidnapping, even killings of different people, would not have to go to jail if they went before some sort of truth commission. They could get an alternative punishment. Is that it?
Yes, something like that. I mean, according to the peace agreements, there is a transitional justice system according to which those who have committed the most serious crimes must be in prison for a shorter period of time in comparison with the regular punishments that the criminal code in Colombia establishes. So, yes, you are right. There is a more lenient, punishment. And, some people disagreed strongly with this stance because they perceive that, I mean, it's a wrong message to society because it's somewhat like certain kind of serious conducts won't be punished at the end of the day. I disagree with that stance, but some people, supported this kind of position, yeah.
And when you look back at the referendum vote, I understand that support for the peace deal, it broke down on different geographic lines within Colombia. Tell us about that.
Yes. The main cities in Colombia, specifically Bogota, Cartagena, Medellin, Barranquilla, as far as I remember, most of these or some of these cities voted against the peace agreement. And it's very telling that most of the regions in which the armed conflict has had a very, very strong influence, these regions voted in favor of the peace agreement. So that's very telling of how the people who have suffered or have experienced firsthand the armed conflict wanted to finish it or to finish it in a definite way. But unfortunately, I don't know, probably the polls didn't take into account these rural areas in which the peace agreement had a strong support.
Well, the FARC, let's just back up for a moment here for our audience. The FARC, it did start out as this Marxist sort of leftist communist rebel group in the 1960s. At the time, there was sort of, it was sort of one of many of these types of groups in Latin America during the Cold War. And a lot of those groups died out after the collapse of the Soviet Union in the early 1990s. So how has the FARC managed to sustain itself since then?
Yeah, that's a good question. In 1990, at least in the Colombian case, several guerrilla groups demobilized due to the new Colombian constitution, the new 1991 constitution. They decided to demobilize, but FARC declined to participate in this constituent process. As for your question, FARC, I mean, this is a controversial point, but I guess that FARC had a very, very strong funding source coming from the narco traffic, and they were able to survive because of narco traffic as one of its main sources.
And so when we talk about the FARC now, do people in Colombia, do they view the FARC as sort of a political guerrilla group today, or is it viewed more as a drug cartel?
I think that this question must be answered depending on the time. I mean, during Uribe era, probably most of the people perceived that the guerrilla was not a political group, but rather a terrorist one. But during the recent peace agreements, some people have perceived that the guerrilla actually has a true will of negotiating and attaining peace. So I think that that perception has changed. And I don't know the specific statistics, but for sure, more people back in Colombia have the idea that the guerrillas has actually a political stance regarding the political scenario back in Colombia.
And if you could, you mentioned the Uribe era in the early 2000s. The Colombian government has tried several different strategies for dealing with the FARC over the years. 15, 20 years ago, as I understand it, the government actually pulled its police and security forces out of parts of Colombia and let the FARC take over. Then, about 8, 9 years ago, you mentioned President Uribe launched this massive military offensive against the FARC. Now we have the current president, Santos, sitting down with them, forming a peace deal. What are some of the lessons from these different approaches?
Okay, first of all, from a constitutional standpoint, the president has the choice of deciding how to maintain the public order. So Uribe decided to do that by means of the military force, while Santos, as you said correctly, decided to do that by means of a peace agreement, by peace conversations. So as for the Uribe experience, in my opinion, the main lesson is that by means of military force, it's impossible to annihilate the FARC guerrillas, to finish the FARC guerrillas. So that's why, in my opinion, Santos, in a correct way, tried to negotiate with the FARC guerrillas in order to attain a peace agreement. That's the main lesson from Uribe era. The main lesson from Santos era, in my opinion, is that he should have been more careful in the sense that he should have opened the spaces for the opposition. He's doing right now this kind of approach with the opposition in order to listen to their opinions, in order to incorporate them to the peace agreements. But probably it should have been better to do that in a previous stage.
Vicente Benitez, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
A reminder that you're listening to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. This week, we're talking about the way forward for Colombia after voters unexpectedly rejected a peace deal with FARC rebels that was years in the making. But we're going to pull in some other experts now who have been following this issue closely. In Bogota, Colombia, we're joined by Angelica Rettberg. She's a professor of political science at the Universidad de los Andes. Also joining us from Bogota is Juan Ferrero. He's the South American bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal. And in Washington, D.C. is Cindy Arnson, the director of the Latin American program at the Woodrow Wilson Center for International Scholars. Welcome to all of you, Juan Ferrero. We heard Vicente Benitez's explanation for why this peace deal failed. What's your take? How come Colombia's government failed to effectively sell this deal to the country's voters?
Well, I think, first of all, you know, for a long time, there was strong support for this process. That began to wane really toward the end in the beginning of 2015. The process for many Colombians just took too long. I think that the government did a very poor job of explaining the positives in this process. And then I think, and I've heard this from people within the government, I think that there was a sense within the government that there would be an easy win. The polls showed that there would be an overwhelming support for the yes vote. And of course, that didn't happen. There were some things that happened on that particular day that that brought down the number of voters. The coast of Colombia, which would have supported and did support the process, very few people went out to vote because of Hurricane Matthew. It sideswiped the coast, and so that was a big problem. But I think that there were just a number of different things. I mean, in the end, a lot of people here do not trust the guerrillas. I think that the president also is unpopular. The process is, as we've all heard, is a process that was very well done, has the support of many countries, the United States, the United Nations, and all that, but that didn't get across to the Colombian people, and that's why they lost.
And Angelica Rettberg, one of the leading opponents of the peace deal was former President Uribe, who led this big offensive against the FARC several years ago under his administration. What happens now? What is the opposition saying and doing now that they've won the vote? Are there specific concrete steps that they have all agreed to move this deal forward?
Thank you. Good morning, everybody. Yes, that's one of the issues I think that should be considered here in addition to what Juan just said. The fact that this referendum became entangled in so many other issues that were not directly related to the agreement has everything to do with the fact that the coming presidential elections of 2018 really played out in a way, in some way during this debate as well. And that's the case for the opposition as well. For instance, some of the arguments that were brought to the public in order to oppose the peace agreement had a lot to do with playing out of, with developing the political agendas that the candidates will have in the upcoming presidential elections. And I think that also has an impact on the solution of this immediate crisis. In a sense, while everybody has said that everybody wants peace and no one has proposed to return to full-blown war, and I think that's a positive sign, still there's really no clear way by which this will all be solved. On the one hand, the people on the no side have said that they want amendments ranging from minor ones to full-blown changes. And on the other hand, the people on the government side have also suggested that they might just simply not consider all the proposed amendments, but just proceed with some constitutionally supported legal norms that might give them the kind of political space that they lack ever since they lost the vote on October 2nd. So I think really the solutions that are being presented to the public, which include everything from renegotiating to including minor amendments, have everything to do with the role of that the opposition wants to play in the coming months leading up to the presidential elections of 2018.
And Cindy Arnson, give us your take on this, because it does seem like President Santos is in a bit of a mess here. On the one side, he spent years negotiating this deal with the FARC, with the far-left rebels. The Colombian public narrowly doesn't support it, and now he sort of has to bring the opposition in to incorporate their ideas and strike a deal with the rebels. How does that work?
Well, let me say, first of all, and thank you again for including me in this conversation, let me just say that President Santos was not obliged by any Colombian law or constitutional procedure to submit the peace accord to a vote. It's a political decision that he made in order to make sure that that the accord would have greater legitimacy, but also to respond to criticism that he was negotiating with these hated guerrilla force behind the backs of the Colombian people. And so it was a way of reassuring the Colombian public that they would have a chance to vote. So now the process going forward is anything but clear, and people are inventing this playbook as they go. The opposition, as Angelica was saying, has insisted on a number of changes, both major and minor. There are some people that actually want a seat at the negotiating table in Havana. There are differences within the opposition, just as there are in any country. There are people, say, in the Conservative Party who are, you know, not as far to the right as Uribe and his coalition. And everyone is jockeying for advantage. But the real question at the end of the day is whether people are going to want to see this whole thing go up in flames, lose the possibility of even an amended peace with the FARC guerrillas, see a return to war, to terrorist attacks, to even the possibility that the FARC, in order to show that it can exact a price for having seen this thing go down the tubes, will increase some very ugly acts of violence. And so at the end of the day, I think all Colombians are going to have to, you know, look over that precipice and decide what it is that they want going forward. Let me just mention also that, say, as Juan was mentioning, the hurricane hadn't happened, and the Caribbean coast and the areas that have been supportive of Santos had been able to vote and cast their ballot. It's probably the case that the yes vote would have won, but by a similar razor-thin majority. And that is a very difficult climate in which to implement all of the very complicated and significant reforms that are contemplated in the peace agreement. And any student of conflict resolution knows that as difficult as it is to get to an accord, the real hard part is in the years that it takes to implement the agreement, not only in letter but in spirit. Colombia has shown itself to be a deeply divided, deeply polarized nation, and that polarization, which has lots of other political issues involved, including the definition of the family and gay rights and all these other things, are getting played out over this piece.
Well, let me turn this to Juan Ferrero. Then Cindy raises a number of good points there. But one thing I wanted to get at, Juan, is give us a picture of the FARC itself right now. How strong and unified are they? Do they still have a lot of resources? Do they still have their own base of popular support?
Yeah, I mean, the FARC is not a popular group, but the FARC is an organization that is very large. They do have influence in certain regions of the country, and it's also a group that is very disciplined. So right now, the FARC is actually playing this pretty well. They've tried to cast themselves as the peacemakers in all of this. They've said that they are going to wait, that they're optimistic, that they think that a new peace accord can be worked out, or I should say amendments can be done to this accord, and that there can be some kind of move forward on this. I was with them twice in the last month or so, just before the plebiscite and then after the plebiscite, and I talked to commanders who were very much pushing that line. I think that there's a couple things that are important here too, is that, you know, the FARC and the military now trust each other, and so the FARC is staying put. They believe that they will be protected by the military. They have been talking to generals and so forth. So there's a level of confidence there that we hadn't had in the past. That's a positive thing. And I think that the FARC has also said that they would be open to discussing modifications in the process. Right now, the government has its negotiators in Cuba. I think that what's going to happen is that they are going to come up with a new accord, that they will present as a new accord. I think that they will try to basically ram this through Congress or through a new plebiscite. If you ask me if there's going to be a new accord, if there's going to be a peace process here that it's going to be implemented, I would say yes, definitely. I would be very surprised if that does not happen. But of course, as Cindy mentioned, there's going to be a lot of polarization. This is going to be done against the no vote. And by the way, people in the government believe that Uribe and the people in the no camp really do not want a peace accord. And so, you know, certainly not one that's realistic. So I think that this is going to be rammed through. And then the big question is going to be, how do you implement this when, you know, half the country is against it? But many people say, you know, this peace accord, even though flawed and situation as polarized as Colombia is better than a conflict.
A reminder that you are listening to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. We're talking about Colombia's prospects for ending a five-decade civil war after voters recently rejected a peace deal between the government and FARC rebels. We're joined by Angelica Rettberg of the University of the Andes in Bogota, by Juan Ferrero, South America Bureau Chief for the Wall Street Journal, and Cindy Arnson, Director of the Latin American Program at the Wilson Center in Washington, D.C. If you want more on undercovered international news from Global Journalist, check us out online at globaljournalist.org. We're also on social media through Facebook and Twitter, and you can subscribe to the video of this program on YouTube or get our podcast from SoundCloud or iTunes. Angelica Rettberg, I wanted to turn this to you because this peace deal did not just involve the FARC rebels, but a number of other military groups inside Colombia, including right-wing paramilitary groups that have sort of morphed into drug gangs and organized criminal groups that are responsible for a lot of the violence in the country. Give us just an update as to how the rejection of this peace deal affects them.
So these were different processes. The one with the paramilitary took place back in 2005, and it led to the demobilization of over 20,000 to 30,000 men. But what you mentioned is really important, because the lure of the ongoing illicit economy that goes on in the country, as Juan was mentioning earlier, in relation to the drug trade, is a serious problem for the 5,000 plus FARC fighters who are awaiting a deal. The fact is that those paramilitary groups of 10 years back, most of them demobilized and stayed demobilized, but some of them have turned into leaders of the ongoing criminal bands or groups that are active in several places of the country, who are basically waiting to go into the territories and into those illicit economies that have sustained FARC so far. And that's an ongoing risk for...
Well, isn't there not a risk that the exact same thing could happen with FARC fighters who demobilize then?
There is a risk. At the same time, Colombia, of course, has changed. The state's capacity has changed over the years. And as opposed, for instance, or in contrast with the Central American experience, where post-conflict crime took many people by surprise, I think the fact that we know that these illicit economies are an opportunity for ongoing crime, and the fact that these groups may just be, you know, attracted, some of them may be attracted back into criminal activity, is something that's known by the Colombian state authorities, who are therefore prepared. So I think it's a risk, but it doesn't mean that the model is due to fail. In fact, if you look at specific FARC fighters, you'll see a genuine interest in really changing their lives. And I think that's something that should be acknowledged and also taken very seriously, both by the government as well as by the opposition, and try to give these people a chance to become civilians.
And Cindy Arnson, tell us about the role of the U.S. in Colombia. The U.S. was a supporter of this peace agreement, which was rejected by the Colombian people. What should we expect? If there is a return to violence, if there is a return to conflict between the Colombian government and the FARC, should we expect that the U.S. will be as heavily involved as it was 10 years ago or 12 years ago in supporting Colombia militarily?
I think most people in the United States, in the Congress and the executive branch, the White House, are not sort of thinking about a return to war in Colombia. The Obama White House, the State Department, during the years of this peace process have been unequivocally supportive and in favor of it, and see it as the logical extension or consequence of the $10 billion in support that the United States has given to Colombia since the origin Plan Colombia 1999-2000, which was originally justified and put forward as a counter-drug plan, because something like 90% of the cocaine that comes into the United States was coming from Colombia alone. And it morphed after the failure of the peace process under the previous government, under Pastrana, in the 1998-2002, it morphed into a program that was also dedicated to fighting the FARC. So that whereas Colombia has dedicated far more resources to this effort over the last 15 years, the United States has given significant assistance to Colombia. I think it's also notable that it's been a bipartisan policy, one of the few in which Republicans and Democrats in this country have agreed on. And in fact, when President Santos came to Washington in February of this year and met with Obama and transformed Plan Colombia into what they were calling Peace Colombia, having, you know, already looking towards the phase of implementation, the Republican-controlled Congress approved more aid to to Colombia than the White House had even asked for. The White House asked for $450 million, and the Congress approved more than that in the event that a peace accord were signed and implemented. So I think that's a sign of incredible bipartisanship, especially, you know, given the budget constraints that exist now and rescissions and sequestration. It is a remarkable sign. So what will happen if all of this falls apart and the fighting resumes? I just don't know. But I do know that there is a great deal of concern in the United States government across the board with the increase in coca cultivation, which is back to the levels of the early 2000s. So that topic that motivated the initial U.S. involvement in Colombia is going to come back front and center.
And Juan Ferrero, the vote against this peace deal in Colombia, it was widely compared with Britain's surprise vote to leave the European Union. And just like in the United Kingdom, the losing side has accused the winning side of making a lot of sort of dishonest arguments during the campaign. The peace deal supporters have said that the opponents of the peace deal weren't being straightforward with the public about the ramifications of this. What are the issues there?
Yeah, I think that there is definitely a parallel there. Just like in the UK, I think that the crowd that was in this case opposed to the peace process and wanted to vote no really didn't think that they were going to win. As I mentioned before, the polls showed that yes would win handily, and of course that wasn't the case. That goes back to the whole issue of whether referendums are really the way to go in countries. I think that in many cases we've seen in many different places in the world, including the United States, that a referendum is a very dicey way to do policy and dangerous and certainly very hard to predict.
But now that you've done one referendum, you can't really go forward with a peace deal without having another referendum. Wouldn't it be fair to say, like, well, we lost the referendum, but we're just going to move the next peace deal through the Congress without having another referendum?
I think that that's exactly what they're going to do, though. I mean, I could be wrong. I think they have a couple of different options here. They could go to the Congress and get support for a new accord, or they could go for a new referendum. The fact is that the president has new political capital because he did win the Nobel Peace Prize here. There is still strong support in this country among, you know, millions of people who do want a peace pact. And the other aspect to this is that the no camp really, up to this point, for many people, has not provided an alternative other than going back to a conflict. I think that that is a problem for them because they need to show that they really have some kind of viable option. And I think it's a problem for Colombia in general. So I think those are things that you face. But going back to really quickly to the question that you made about the question you had about manipulation and so forth. One of the issues here that was really helped the no camp was that the message here was that Colombia would turn into Venezuela, basically, that this would be Castro Chavismo, referring to Fidel Castro and former leader Hugo Chavez of Venezuela. Everyone here in Colombia knows very well that Venezuela is just a complete disaster. And so the no camp really hammered home on that. It's a simple message. It's a direct message, and it worked.
That's all we've got for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Missouri School of Journalism and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Our thanks again to Cindy Arnson, Juan Ferrero, Angelica Rettberg, and Vicente Benitez. Our assistant producers this week are Alejandra Arredondo, Steve Dawson, and Huilan Zahn. Anadil Iftikhar is our visuals editor, and Vera Tan is producer. Pat Akers of KBIA Mid-Missouri Public Radio is our audio engineer. Our director is Travis McMillan of RJI. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.